Thank you very much. Good afternoon. I'm coming to you from the traditional lands of the Cammeraygal people of the Eora Nation. It's fabulous to have the opportunity to speak on this panel. I think what I have to say actually picks up pretty nicely from what Adam just spoke to you about. So I was going to start by just giving a quick overview of what the role of public policy is in the development of sustainable financial markets. Bring it in a little bit to be a bit more specific about what the regulators in Australia, and that's specifically the CFR agencies, have been doing, most specifically with climate-related risks, and then just quickly at the end have make a few comments about what engagement with the financial sector has looked like. So just starting with the role for public policy, you know, I think the ultimate goal here is to make sure that markets have the right data to assess climate risk and to value sustainable business models and opportunities. And in particular, you want participants to have access to data that provides useful information in a way that's consistent over time and it's consistent across firms. And given that this is a really rapidly evolving space, I think it's pretty clear there's a role for public policy to help coordinate the efforts to achieve this. The first way that public policy can assist with that sort of price discovery and the pricing of risks is by establishing standards that ensure financial market participants have a common understanding of what is actually being priced in any given instrument. And that's particularly important when the concepts we're dealing with are really complex. And as I said before, exactly what it is we're pricing, our understanding of that's evolving pretty quickly as well. So more specifically, I think there's a case for public policy to provide regulatory guidance on what sort of standards of climate risk management should look like and to coordinate the outcomes in areas like disclosure. An added complexity in the case of pricing climate risk is that history is not a particularly good guide to the future. So a lot of the things that we would normally do to think about risk aren't going to be as useful as they might normally be. And it means that tools like scenario analysis are going to be particularly helpful. And I think in that case, there's also a public policy or an argument for public policy to help with price discovery by helping to define what a set of scenarios looks like. So there's at least some commonality in the information that's being provided by firms. So turning to what CFR agencies have been doing in this space, the first thing to note here is that there's a sub-working group of the CFR total group. So it's called the Working Group on the Financial Implications of Climate Change, which I always shrink down to the Working Group on Climate Change. If you want a more detailed account of what that working group has been up to and what the plans are for the next year, you can actually find an update of that on the CFR website. Unsurprisingly, the activities line up pretty closely with the points I've just made about the role of public policy in financial markets or the potential role it can play. So in terms of establishing a common understanding around these definitions, CFR agencies have been monitoring development of taxonomies that Adam's already mentioned and sustainable finance frameworks from overseas. So taxonomy is kind of a fancy word for the definitions that help explain what a sustainable activity or a sustainable financial product looks like. These taxonomies can also help to establish principles for handling situations where where definitions conflict. So for example, one of the dominant taxonomies at the moment is the European taxonomy, and it embeds a principle called do no significant harm. And that basically means an activity can't be classified as sustainable if it achieves one of the sustainability objectives, such as reducing carbon emissions at the expense of another. So if, for example, it does that by reducing biodiversity, you can't then classify that as sustainable. I think it's pretty straightforward to understand why having these commonly understood definitions will help improve the quality of the information that's available to investors and the development of financial market products. And something else that Adam mentioned, or maybe it was Gordon, The globally integrated nature of financial markets means that it's really important to think about this not just from the Australian economy, but to make sure that we're going to benefit from internationally recognised definitions. But at the same time, you have to understand that Australia isn't, you know, the Australian economy is not structured the same way as other economies. So you do need to have a taxonomy that's also fit for purpose for individual countries. So, you know, the objective here is to find a way to describe Australia's activities in a way that meshes with these existing taxonomies that tend to have a bit more of a focus on whether something's green or not green, and to include this something that's really important for Australia, which is, you know, what does that transition from our current state to the net zero state look like? So both the Reserve Bank and the Treasury participate in international discussions on taxonomies through our membership of groups like the G20 Sustainable Finance Working Group. Domestically, ASIC and APRA have both been observers on the steering committee for the Australian Sustainable Finance Initiative, ASFI, which I think is a really interesting organisation in the context of the discussion that we're having today. And one of their objectives, amongst a whole range of sustainability objectives, is to implement a sustainable finance taxonomy for Australia. The second focus for the CFR has been on improving the quality and comparability of disclosures on climate risk by Australian companies. So ASIC has really been leading the way on this. And they've been encouraging Australian companies to use the Task Force on Climate-Related Financial Disclosure Framework, which is the TCFD that you'll see a lot of people referring to. This is another example where there's sort of an international standard evolving. And if you're interested, they've actually just released their fourth status report a couple of days ago. But actually turning that sort of internationally agreed sort of framework into the Australian context is an important task. I think one of the things that's really interesting in this space is that investor pressure for better information, better data, has actually already increased the voluntary disclosure of climate risks by many Australian corporates, because this is such an important source of information on climate risk and opportunity. So I don't know if you were paying attention, but Guy de Bell gave a speech last week. He's the deputy governor at the bank. He's also the chair of the CFR Working Group on Climate Change. The current global debate and the debate going into COP26 is around, you know, what could and should be done above and beyond the existing legal requirements to disclose material climate-related risks. And in particular, the debate is whether disclosure should be made mandatory or whether voluntary disclosure is sufficient. The final area I just wanted to touch on is scenario analysis, which I've already mentioned is a really important piece of that price discovery information transfer process. The lead there is really being taken by APRA on behalf of the CFR agencies, and they've been working on developing scenarios to test the exposure of Australia's five largest banks. That's labelled the Climate Vulnerability Assessment, the CVA. That's been a big piece of work this year and will continue to be a big piece of work next year. And basically here, you start with internationally recognised standards for setting scenarios, or the narratives for scenarios, and we've taken our lead on that from our scenarios developed by the Network for the Greening of the Financial System. And then there's been quite a bit of work go into that to translate that sort of high-level narrative into the Australian context so that the banks have the sort of granular information they need to assess the risks. So I'm happy to answer any questions later about the design of the CVA scenarios, but in the interest of time, I thought it would really be useful just to touch on a couple of points from our experience of the CVA to talk about what engagement with the CFR agencies, between the CFR agencies and the financial sector, looks like. And I think the bottom line here is there's a huge value in having a really active engagement. This is a really complex problem that we're trying to solve. it's an evolving space. We're all learning by doing. So the opportunities to speak to each other as we go through this process are really, really invaluable. I've already made a couple of comments about how CFR agencies are looking offshore to sort of learn what we can from what's gone on overseas. Domestically, I think we recognised really early on that the success of the CVA exercise would really benefit from all participants having a good common standard of what the scenarios are and what we were trying to achieve. So APRA has been working really closely with the ABA, the Australian Banking Association, and the participating banks in the design phase of the scenario. I think the other thing to recognise here is that there's a long way to go from a climate model through to the sort of a financial stress test a bank might do, and there's quite a complex chain of information there. So another thing that's been really important is to engage with experts at different points in this chain to make sure that we do the best job that we can of getting the information from the climate science to the scenario work being done in banks. We've also engaged pretty actively with investors to understand what they think they need to be able to do a good risk assessment. So I think just to wrap it up, the bottom line of all that is this is an area where really active engagement between regulators and investors and participants in financial markets is a key element of the approach that we've taken and hopefully the success that we'll have. So I'll leave it there, Gordon.
That's great, Alex. Thank you. So we've had a range or three perspectives on various issues around sustainable finance and where that may go, particularly not just for Australia, but the region and globally. I'm going to move to questions from you, but I'm going to just, Alex, if I can ask you a quick question, and it's really a follow-up around natural capital. That's from what Adam said and from what Amy said. You talked a lot about climate change finance. How do you think around issues around natural capital, or particularly on if identifying risk around management of land and water, that risk can then be priced into loans and new instruments can be created? How's your thinking or your perception of that issue going on the natural capital side?
Right. So I think the answer is, at a very conceptual level, anything that improves people's access to good quality information that allows them to price risks better is a good thing. So then the question, we sort of take a step back and say, well, what can we be doing to assist with that? I think it's probably fair to say that at this point we've been quite focused on climate change and climate-related risk. We haven't really expanded our activities very actively into the natural capital space, but we are paying quite a bit of attention to things like the TNFD, the natural capital equivalent of the TCFD. These topics are coming up quite a lot in international fora that various CFR agencies participate in. So as you would know, the banks involved with the G20, we obviously interact with the IMF. We're involved with the Network on the Greening of the Financial System. ASIC is participating in IOSCO. APRA obviously has overlap with some of what Adam was talking about, what might be happening in the Basel Committee. So I think it's fair to say in principle we would 100% agree that better pricing is always and everywhere a better thing, but we're a bit more on the just getting to grips with one thing before we head too actively down the road of the next.
Yeah, thanks. I think it's still quite exploratory around some of these, especially around the accuracy of data and how do you apply that to instruments. I think Craig Emerson's got a question, so maybe just let Craig ask that question. Then I've got some other questions that have come through the chat. And also feel free to interact with each other. And if you want to respond to what someone has said, feel free to do that. So Craig, can I just hand over to you?
Thanks very much, Gordon. Looking at the road to Glasgow and a report from the International Energy Agency that came out just last week, I started to wonder whether markets are actually ahead now of governments and in pricing in negative externalities. It's a really phenomenal development, but it seems to me that we actually are having leaders responding both for altruistic reasons to the challenge of climate change, but also because they have to. And I know the Reserve Bank has warned that, if we in Australia don't respond adequately, then that has implications for the cost of capital. So has the Treasurer, Jos Frydenberg. So are we seeing something dramatic happening just in the last few months, where normally the markets are behind and then they realise that there's some pollution or, you know, a river's been polluted or something, and governments act first by cleaning up, stopping the pollution and cleaning up the rivers? It seems to me now that maybe the markets are doing the reacting first and then governments have no little choice but to respond to that. And one tangible expression of that is the creation of a carbon exchange by the Clean Energy Regulator in Australia, where we talked about the E part of ESD, and I'm not just limiting climate change, but there's a premium on the price of Australian carbon credit units, which are for, signify one tonne of carbon has been saved. There's a premium where they also do something else, such as contribute to the activity contributes to biodiversity. So forest regeneration could be creating greater biodiversity. And then another area in Indigenous Australia, savanna burning, they're commanding a premium for that of $10 per Australian carbon credit unit, all of which is happening through the market. This is private buyers who are lifting this up. So little speech, I suppose, but the point of it is, are we seeing something quite phenomenal here in just the last few months, if not the last few weeks leading to Glasgow, where the markets are saying, we're going to price in these environmental costs, including emissions into the atmosphere?
Thanks very much, Craig. I might just ask, maybe go to Amy, then Adam, and then Alex. And feel free as well in responding to Craig's question, also to comment on anything else that you have raised or heard from your colleagues today. And then I'll come back with some questions from the chat. So, Amy.
Thanks, Gordon. Craig, I think you're absolutely right. The markets are leading in this instance, and the innovation or adaptation of ways in which markets measure and value action is now being increasingly applied in this sphere, which is fantastic. And I do think that technology like geospatial mapping and the ability to quickly absorb that data and understand and analyze that data and produce a result through our faster processing, and we're starting to get into mega data sets and the ability to chew through those very quickly only increases every year, and it makes this kind of activity possible. So I absolutely agree that that's happening. It's almost like the standards will struggle to keep up a little bit, mm-hmm. but in the world of regulation, that's also not unusual. But what I love about it is that it is a more holistic system. Because just one measure, for example, gross emissions, we've moved away from that. We talk about net. And then if you're just talking about what's going into the air, what about the ability of the land to absorb? So being able to more fully, to use all those measures to more fully understand what's going on in the ecosystem, while complicated, I agree with you. We can eventually arrive at a price for everything.
Might move over to Adam. Just one observation, Amy, just when you, because it's, these things are structured in standards and of course, typically they're responsive. I think that's right. But it shows just how important international cooperation is. And there's a lot of chatter about, oh, the world is broken down, the systems are broken down. We certainly have political tension and difficulties, but that doesn't mean some of the basic institutions and frameworks that work through the nitty-gritty of cooperation and economic development and growth, they're still in place and those still are functioning. So taking it back to those standard-setting bodies is really important. I might just pass over to Adam then to respond to Craig and any other things you've heard, Adam, from your colleagues here today.
Yeah, thanks, Gordon, and thanks, Craig. I think it's a really good point. I mean, I think a lot of governments have been hesitant to price carbon, but markets haven't, right? Markets have been quite happy to put a price on it, and that's what they've done. Whether it's things like insurance and the ability to get insurance for particular projects, whether it's the ability to get a loan for a particular project and also the interest rates on those loans, and then when they're collateralized, the interest rates on those bonds, we can definitely see that there is a price on carbon and a price on the environment, which is emerging. And this is hardly surprising. I mean, this is the job of banks is to make sure they properly price risk. And they observe, as the data shows, that people who are good at taking into account environmental, social, and governance considerations also happen to be really good at running their business as well, given they have that awareness of these things. I suppose the issue is probably the main one is that the pace that we're seeing in terms of markets pricing these things isn't happening at the rate that we need it to be happening. And that's because there are some obstacles in the way. So it's really making sure we get those frameworks right to make sure that they can price these things adequately. Part of the issue here, I think there's probably two. One of them is in some instances, governments are being tempted to actually get in the way. So we've had a really amazing discussion in Australia just recently where there was a suggestion that we should start providing subsidies and make it easier for some of these environmentally dangerous businesses to be able to access loans to overcome the pricing that's happening properly in markets, which is really quite a breathtakingly appalling public policy suggestion that came out there. The other part of this, though, is that there are still these obstacles, and that's around Basel internationally and these domestic regulations we need to make sure that we provide the framework that's needed for that pricing to occur properly. In many ways, this is a collective action problem. We do need agreement around taxonomies and the ability to get this data. So even though markets are moving in this direction, they're not doing it in the pace that we need and the scale we need, and that's because there are these obstacles still. So there is still a role for government there, but I think it's creating that pressure, which is really good.
Thanks, Adam. Alex?
Yeah, I guess I have a couple of observations. The first one is that, yes, there's been a lot going on in energy prices in the last couple of weeks. I would actually say that the pressure from financial markets and investors in this space has actually been pretty consistent for a much longer time than just the last couple of weeks. So I think the last couple of weeks is actually an interesting interaction between that sort of longer term trend and a couple of more short term pressure points showing up for completely other reasons, but it certainly has highlighted the nature of the trade-offs and the policy issues that need to be discussed in ways that I think are quite helpful. I think it's really brought some of the debates to the fore that should be. Just to the point about the role of public policy, I think I made a case that we can provide a point of coordination, because I think what happens with a lot of well-intentioned investors, for example, they can all be trying to disclose relevant information, but without some kind of coordinating principle, they can be doing it in different ways, which from an investor perspective is a little bit tricky. So what investors are looking for is that consistency across firms, across country, through time. So I think there's a role for public policy there. Another really interesting case is worth looking at if you're trying to understand this point about premiums. So you've talked about it in the context of Australian carbon credits. But the German government has established bond lines of green bonds that are basically twinned with standard bonds. And the whole purpose behind that was to give investors a sense, well, here's the, you know, the the normal yield curve or the standard yield curve. And here's another yield curve for green bonds that are all carefully slated back to specific green projects. And so that's another way that sort of the public sector has actually tried to assist the private sector with this quite complex pricing problem that they have, because how do you decide what to do with all the information if it's not standardised? So I think the bottom line of all that is there's some really long-term trends. There's a really strong role for public policy. Just in terms of responding to what other people have said, I just wanted to comment on Amy's comment about the IPSF. So this is a body that's trying to sort of find the commonality in different taxonomies and different kind of sustainable finance disclosure frameworks. Just it might be of interest to you that ASFI also has joining the IPSF as one of its sort of things that it thinks Australia should be doing to sort of push ourselves further along that road. That's all I was going to say, Gordon.
Okay, thanks. So do you want to come in? I've got a couple of questions appearing in the chat box. So come in. Amy, did you want to say something? Or you? No, okay. I've got a couple of questions appearing in the chat box. But one's, and Alex, you've all highlighted the importance of international cooperation on this, that the rules are set globally that are applied domestically, and exploring and understanding how things work across a range of markets is really helpful. Can I ask you, where do you see the priorities for areas of cooperation, not just in the standard setting bodies, but often some of that conversation also occurs in forums like G20 and in APEC. And some of those conversations are on the substance and some are on developing capability and capacity. And how would you, for example, around APEC, what would be what's the initial priority? Is it data management? Is it risk management? Is it the supply of the instruments? Is it understanding? And where do you see that? And then which countries, and how do you have a differentiated approach to really quite developed and sophisticated markets? But Amy, I think you said that land matters to everyone, and it's certainly in Asia and the Pacific, it matters greatly. So how do you play that game in APEC and G20 around where the priorities are? Where do you focus now? So if you were to do one thing, what would be the first thing you do there? So I'm going to ask you, Alex, Amy, and then Adam. Sorry to throw you in there first, Alex.
No, that's fine. The problem with the question was, what's the one thing that you would do? Because there are so many things you could do. I really think this point about taxonomy development is really important, and getting the definitions that can be commonly agreed and are sufficiently nuanced that they're suitable for a lot of different countries. So I think a lot of the discussion in places like the G20 have come in from countries where defining what a sustainable transition looks like is really, really important. So countries like Australia, countries like Japan, it's about saying, well, this is where we are and we kind of know where we want to get to. How do we ensure that the investment that comes in doesn't just say, well, I'll only invest in green things because that's what I've got a good definition for? How do we make sure that they invest in projects that will reduce emissions, make sure that we're moving along that path? Because sometimes you can actually, get more from, halving the emissions reduction of a heavily polluting industry than you can from getting to zero from an industry that's not polluting very much to start with. So how do you make sure that transition is funded? And I think a part of it comes down to the difficult task of defining what that transition looks like and what, a good investment in that sense looks like.
Thanks. So definitions, Alex, is your key thing. Amy?
If I had to pick one, Actually, it's two, but they're connected. I would say reporting and disclosure. I mean, but you have to disclose, you have to be kind of reporting on, and a little bit on the same basis to understand what it is that is being disclosed. But I would say disclosure, and it goes to, there was a question in the chat around, you know, is there a risk that, for example, heavy carbon producing industry moves into the private funding market so that they don't have to suffer perceived value or real value destruction as a penalty for their activities. So that's where I think there is a role for governments to encourage and possibly in some ways to mandate disclosure of activities. But in so doing, I think it's important that the disclosure requirements are balanced and are not necessarily just on perceived harm, but also on other benefits, because same concept as net zero. Companies will have a balance of activities that they undertake, some which are perceived to be environmentally harmful, but maybe can improve over time, and some which may ameliorate that activity. So I think the disclosure is tricky, but it is the one thing that would always indicate whether, I suppose, a company's activities are being appropriately valued.
Adam?
For me, if I had to pick my one, it's probably going to be data. These things go together, of course. You need to agree on taxonomies internationally on what constitutes green. But then we really need to provide assistance, particularly to developing countries, so they can actually collect that data and then they can actually do those reviews themselves. There's a really big issue here around, for example, stated preferences versus revealed preferences. One of the things that we did recently was did some data scraping of about 700 of Australia's largest companies across their websites to look at their plans and who had plans on reducing emissions and who had plans on net zero. But what we then did was calculated what's their actual emissions rate. So we looked at their greenhouse gas emissions per their dollar of revenue and found that there was a really big mismatch between those two things. So a huge challenge, I think, for countries in general, but particularly developing countries, is to get that data collection capacity to make sure they have organizations that will provide that data. When we think about natural capital, for example, there's a lot of issues around having access to technologies like remote sensing technologies to be able to collect that data on farms and in the agricultural context. Which is something else that there's simple technologies they won't have and they won't be able to participate in that sense. So I think really providing that assistance to provide that, to get that data, which means supporting organizations that can start collecting it. It means providing those technologies, but also the technical assistance around the regulations of this data to make sure that the data is accessible, that we don't have monopolies over this data. So a lot of competition issues are emerging around the use and access to data here as well. So helping them in that regulatory front as well, I think, is really important.
Thanks very much, Adam. So that's a really nice set of responses. Alex, can I go back to, you've seen the question there by Diane Smith-Gander around the more heavily emitting firms being moved into private capital markets. And that's kind of the classic thing around financial intermediation. Go back to the 70s or the 80s and the conversations around when you regulate banks, you just force then the activity to occur in non-bank financial intermediaries. And what we see here is when you're trying to regulate the rules around authorized capital or institutional capital or finance, you shift those funds from those institutions to, they disintermediate to other, and that's really private ownership or private capital. You got any reflections on how do you bring everything together, or is that a good thing? Is it neutral? How do you think about it?
Yeah, so can I just start by saying that I actually agree with Adam and Amy's answers to your first question as well. That was pretty much, you know, number two and number three things that I would have said. And there's a bit of a chicken and egg problem because they do all interact. You know, I think I tried to make the case that what's really important is that the information is well understood and available. And so if you're a bank, you're responsible for managing your risks and determining what you think an acceptable risk is for you according to, you know, your risk assessment. And climate is another source of financial risk. So in that sense, the better the information, the better they can manage the risk, the better the decisions they will make. Banks have different risk appetites to, you know, private equity, to other investors in the market. So I think it's quite, you know, it's sort of natural as something that hasn't been well priced becomes better priced. You know, maybe different people in the market will be have different views on whether they're willing to invest or not invest. I think ultimately what matters is that the price is set well and price discovery processes are facilitated. That's ultimately what's important. And so I don't know. Yeah, so this isn't really about regulating activities as much as making sure that the best information is available to all participants. And I think Amy and Adam's answers to your previous question both point in exactly the same direction.
Thanks. And Amy, I noticed you've got to go. You've got something you have to go to. So thank you very much. It's been great to have you here. So we might continue. Can I ask Adam and Alice, I don't know how much you work in APEC, but one thing that comes up in the questions as well is PEC, one of the things around, or the Pacific Economic Cooperation Council, is co-chaired by the US and China. And actually the relationship is highly functional and constructive across PEC in general. How do you see particularly the fact of this issue around, but not just climate change, but natural capital more generally, is something that all countries actually have an inherent interest in. And even if there are differences in some areas, including in areas of security and strategy, that there are other areas where there is scope for cooperation and working together. Have you got any reflections on how would you play that in a forum like APEC, and including in G20? And Adam, you and I will, I think that we've all had experience with those forums, but maybe I'll go to you first, Adam, and then to Alex around that.
Yeah, it's a really good question. I think, I mean, both the US and China, but certainly particularly from the Biden administration, have tried to make it very clear that they want to carve out different areas of the relationship between US and China. And they want to have a tense relationship in some areas. They might not say they want it, but they're certainly pursuing policies that are going to be more confrontational. And that's in trade and security and military. But then they're very much trying to say that in climate change, for example, we want to keep that isolated. So that's sort of a ring-fenced area that we can keep cooperating in that space. So really the question, I think, and this is particularly a question for China, is how effective that's going to be and whether they will be able to keep those areas ring-fenced from other areas. I think the incentives are on our side here, and that's particularly because, like you say, that all countries have an incentive to do this anyway. Even when you had the US, which was going in the wrong direction on climate, China was still pursuing these priorities domestically. I think in natural capital, that's very true as well. So in many ways, the incentives are pushing them towards cooperation. So I think that's definitely going to be on our side. But it is a question of whether they can continue to ring fence these particular areas. APEC is really well suited for this. It has a history of being able to find pathways forward. So countries can come together where there's not necessarily a very obvious thing that they can do together or very specifically, but they can work together to try and find some kind of pathway forward that will work on those issues. I think the G20 as well has got a huge history after the 2008 crisis on financial regulation. So it's very well placed, particularly through some of its working groups, to look at these issues as well. So I think I'm pretty optimistic. I think it's sort of pushing on an open door in that sense, where you've got trying to get cooperation in an area where incentives are pushing these countries anyway. I think we're pretty well placed for this to be somewhere they can do a lot of work. And we've got the Italian presidency, the G20 coming up at the end of this month. If you look at what the finance ministers have been talking about in the G20 space, they're seeing a lot of discussion on these issues. So I think we are in that sort of pathway finding mode, which I think is looking really good.
Thanks. Alex?
I don't have a lot of direct experience with APEC as such, but I am aware of, you know, the G20 Sustainable Finance Working Group, where a lot of the activity in the G20 space is. I think that's quite a cooperative group, and there's a genuine desire to sort of find the common ground that Adam was talking about. And I think it's really important to take a little step back and say there are a lot of issues, and this is a really complex space. So, you know, there is quite a bit of discussion that's required to find out where those points of common ground are and kind of work out from there. And so that's one forum where it's definitely happening. I think the other space where, just to Adam's comments before, China has been quite active, and now the US is more active since the change in the administration, is the NGFS. So it's the Network on the Greening of the Financial System. So that was started in 2017. It was initially a group of central banks, many of whom had sort of regulatory responsibilities as well. That's grown enormously. And there's a whole range of different working groups that are quite, I guess it's a bit more in the nuts and bolts category rather than the just let's lay out a roadmap space. And they've made really impressive progress on things like scenario analysis and kind of what might that look like and how would you go about doing that. And within those sorts of areas, there's a lot of countries, including China and including the US, participating actively. And I think there's a really genuine sense of commitment to trying to find a positive way forward, but you don't want to understate how hard that is. I mean, it's a quite a difficult thing to do, so it will take a bit of time. And I guess just on that point, I would say, at some stage, you just have to get in there and start doing things, and not let the, you know, perfection be the enemy of progress. You have to just get in there and start learning by doing, to some extent.
Thanks. That's very wise. Can you just give us a couple of examples of when you reflect on scenario analysis? What sort of things are you looking at within that frame, and how do you bring those things together?
Right. So I can talk about the APRA CVA and how that's so. So the NGFS has a working group that has, over a number of years, defined a set of scenarios that everyone sort of feels like are a good common set of scenarios. They've actually set up quite a bit of infrastructure to allow countries to sort of access kind of what that means at the global scale, and even to get that down to a more granular kind of national level set of data for some countries. But you start with the science, and then you think about how do you translate science into, you know, macroeconomic variables that we're all familiar with, things like productivity. What does rising temperatures mean for productivity growth going forward? And then you go from the macroeconomics and you think about, well, what sort of industrial structural change might climate change and the technology you have available mean? And then you sort of translate that down into the sorts of variables that a financial institution like a bank might use to sort of test its the climate risks on its book. So for Australia, obviously the mortgage book is really important. But if we're thinking about transition risk, structural change in under different scenarios is another thing that's quite important. And I think the interesting thing will be to see what comes out of that exercise. Tried to make the point, it's a learning by doing. So it's a bit about, well, what do the banks come up with? And then, you know, what does that make them think about? And so how should we refine the scenario analysis framework going forward based on that discussion?
Okay, thanks. I think we've come to time. Maybe I'll just very quickly, Adam, is there anything you'd like to say at the end? sum up, and then to Alex, just a 30-second sum up.
Sure. I think for me, it's looking at what came from the IMF last week, which was looking at the growth forecasts that have come out and showing a huge number of problems that we're facing there. A big one being a two-speed global economy, where we're seeing, in some instances, an overheating of the rich world economies and stagnation of the poor world economies, particularly in Asia. And we're going to see a really nasty situation emerge where they're going to start exporting pain towards each other. I think the rich world will potentially, when they normalize monetary policies, start sending financial instability towards the poor world. And then the poorer world will then, because their vaccination rates are about 5%, so extremely low, you might start seeing more variants from COVID coming there as well. So there's a huge priority to make sure that we help countries in Asia, mainly the developing countries. And we know that there's an issue around the sustainability of these recoveries as well, if you look at the forecast on growth. So there's a real need to boost growth here. And I think one of the areas, if particularly given it's such a strong area for cooperation, is to look more at sustainable investment, to use this as an opportunity to funnel all of this glut of savings into productive investments, to boost productivity, to boost growth, get really sustainable growth in every sense of the word sustainable, and to use that as a real catalyst for trying to promote this post-COVID recovery, which I think is really going to be the big issue that's going to face a lot of emerging economies as they start to move forward. So that would be my concluding thoughts, Gordon.
Thanks very much, Adam. And it's a hard world. Alex, anything?
I think, you know, just a couple of observations. So I think the first thing is, even though much of what I've spoken about is about climate change, I think, pushing that concept into the broader concept of sustainability is an important thing to do. A little bit of it's about starting with something that you can manage and expanding from there. So I think this is a really important conversation from that perspective. Something that Adam said made me think the other thing that I should say as a concluding remark is we talk a lot about climate risk, which automatically puts it all into a bit of a negative frame, but obviously risk is two-sided and risk comes with opportunities. And I think, you know, a part of this process is actually trying to make sure we don't neglect to think about those opportunities at the same time as we're thinking about managing the risks that we face. And then just another reaction to what Adam just said, I think at the moment it is a really interesting interaction between those longer term forces that we're dealing with and something that's quite, in relative terms, quite acute and quite specific to now, so the pandemic response. And I think it's sort of highlighting a whole lot of interesting things, including how much you can do when you really feel a sense of urgency around doing it. So I think there's a couple of really interesting lessons to draw from the current conjuncture as well.
That's great. So can I, the positive dimension actually is the framing around the natural capital side of there are missing markets and that's holding back opportunities, not just for financing, but actually sustainable land and water management in every country. So I think that's a very positive frame there. Can I thank Adam Triggs, Alex Heath, and Amy Oster for your discussion today? It's been really helpful and very insightful. And I will say for myself, I'm taken just by the value, even at this stage, of technical cooperation or the nuts and bolts on disclosure, on technology and data, and on reporting and just how important that is. And there's a really rich menu there, and that if it works on the technical side, it can also work and be useful on the political side for countries. Thank you very much. I would say we hope to have a couple more webinars, and we've got webinars coming up on essential services in APEC on the 1st of November, on the APEC State of the Region report and the value of APEC on the 8th of November, and digital transformation and some major issues there on the 22nd of November. So thank you all. Any other comments and questions, please approach us all. myself or Bonnie or the speakers today, and thank you very much for your time. And we realise, I mean, understand just how valuable it is. So thank you.
Thanks, Gordon. Thanks very much.
Thanks, Gordon. Thanks, Bonnie.